From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, our Emmy week continues with two nominees in the category Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series: Christina Applegate, who stars in Dead to Me, and Natasha Lyonne, who co-created and stars in the series Russian Doll. Lyonne has a second nomination for her writing on Russian Doll. The main character in Russian Doll keeps dying and then returning to life with no clue why. Lyonne nearly died in 2005 while addicted to heroin, when she had a collapsed lung, hepatitis C, and a heart infection. In Dead to Me, Christina Applegate stars as a woman grieving the loss of her husband. One of her character's storylines comes from Applegate's experiences after having a double mastectomy.
It's an amputation, and you physically and emotionally go through so much when you lose a part of you.
That's on Fresh Air. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Emmy Awards are coming up soon, Sunday, September 22nd. This week, we're featuring interviews with some of the nominees. Our first interview today is with Natasha Lyonne, who's nominated in two categories, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series and Outstanding Writing in a Comedy Series. Both are for her work on the Netflix series Russian Doll, which she co-created. When the series begins, she's at a party for her 36th birthday, drinking and smoking cocaine-laced marijuana. A little later in the episode, she leaves the party, and while crossing the street, she's hit by a taxi and killed. But then she finds herself back at the party, and a few minutes later, she dies again. Here she is describing the situation to a family friend who's a therapist.
Last night I died.
What do you mean?
Last night was my birthday.
Correct.
All right. I went to Maxine's. We got into a fight, so I tried to leave. I fell down the stairs. I broke my neck, and I died.
Okay.
So then, I'm back at the party. I try to leave, fall down the stairs, break my neck again, right? So I died. That's four times. Also, my cat just literally disappeared.
As we'll soon hear, the idea of dying and coming back to life has personal resonance for Lyonne. She started acting as a child. When she was six, she was a recurring character on Pee-wee's Playhouse. She was the narrator in Woody Allen's Everybody Says I Love You. She co-starred in American Pie and starred in But I'm a Cheerleader and The Slums of Beverly Hills. In 2014, she received her first Emmy nomination for her role as Nikki Nichols in Orange is the New Black. Natasha Lyonne, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
We've all had experiences that nearly killed us. The car crash that was narrowly avoided, the stairs we almost fell down. I'm sure you experienced those, but you probably also experienced the kind of near death from drugs and being hospitalized. And I'm wondering how that fed the premise of the show.
Certainly my very real experiences wildly informed the things that felt topical to me, you know, that felt very tangible, that might otherwise feel esoteric or out of reach, kind of these questions about life and death and these questions and riddles, consume me, and ultimately also the things I find funniest because they're so dark.
I'm wondering if you gave certain of your own characteristics, your personality traits, to the character, or perhaps certain characteristics that you've outgrown. For example, like your character is determined not to have connections to other people. She doesn't want to be in a committed relationship until she's in her 60s and preparing for a time when she'll need someone to help take care of her. She sees relationships as impinging on her freedom and pushes people away. Did you go through that kind of phase yourself and give those characteristics to the character?
Partially. I think that's definitely a philosophy that I have almost more as a feminist stance of sort of who are you to determine my timeline? You know, like, why is that legal? I mean, my father was a boxing promoter. His big dream was he wanted to be like a Don King figure and bring Mike Tyson to the Tel Aviv Hilton when we lived in Israel. I grew up with a lot of boxing in my life, a lot of these kind of tough guy sort of Pacino and De Niro figures. And the thing I would keep noticing in them is that they weren't limited by time or this need to reproduce that society kind of puts on as the woman's burden. Oh, now I'm a worthy member of the species because look, I've got a partner. I've got my plus one who can get me in the room. From Adam's rib, here I come. You know, it was a sort of all that mentality.
So did you want to be a tough guy when you were growing up?
I don't know that that's really changed, Terry.
Did you model
it a little less self-destructively.
Yes, right.
Now I'm just a tough guy at all you guys. You know, not you, of course, because you're
me, of course.
A giant.
Right.
But, I think, for a long time, I think I thought being a tough guy meant being tough at oneself. Like, how much can I take? And now I think I see it, you know, quite differently.
Yeah, how much can I take is really modeled on a boxing model, right?
A little bit. And I think it's, you know, deeper than that. I think I'm sort of, you know, my lineage is dark survivors. I mean, I come from a real Auschwitz stock. So, you know, Hitler was a big player in my childhood. And it was this kind of, you know, mentality of surviving. And that, you know, even no matter what sort of horrors life throws your way, you know, that was something that had been endured by my grandmother and my grandfather. And, you know, therefore, it was kind of the litmus test of, you know, a human experience.
So you were preparing to be the tough guy because your father was the boxer, like enduring in the ring and taking it was part of the ethic you were exposed to, but also the larger ethic of, like, you have to survive on your instincts to survive the Holocaust. Most people die, but, you know, maybe you can survive. And, you know, it's a dangerous time. It always will be because you're Jewish. It sounds like a very frightening environment to grow up in, where you're always, like, bracing yourself for something horrible to happen. Physical blow,
you know,
or just, you know, people, like, finding out who you are,
Derry,
and killing you.
The headline is everything's fine now. You know what I mean? People love Russian Doll. So it's the good days are upon us. You know, I certainly think it made me very curious to sort of, like, see what else was out there and kind of being like, what's this? LSD. Let's see where this takes us.
So when you took LSD, did you have, like, good trips in which you thought, like, that it seemed like transcendent experiences, or did you have, like, nightmarish?
It's a funny thing to talk about, because from where I'm sitting now, I'm so glad for all of these experiences. You know, they really are the things that you know, shaped a very specific point of view. I'd done enough sort of psychedelics that I like to get very Jewish when I say that. I've done enough sort of psychedelics that, what can I tell you? Sometimes we're up and sometimes we're down, Terry. What can you do? You got a good batch of acid. You got a bad batch of shrooms. Who knows where it takes you? That's what my rabbi always used to say.
I'm sure. So you studied Talmud pretty seriously, because when you were young, you were in Israel.
Yeah, when I wasn't dropping acid,
when
I
you
was
weren't
studying Talmud.
Well, maybe
that's
the two went together
say.
Nicely for you?
Nobody knows. I'm going to do the rest of it like this.
Okay. So, I'm sorry, this is another addiction-related question. But,
oh, sure. Yeah. Why stop now?
No, I've spoken to people who had, like, opioid issues. You know, like, they had been addicted to opioids, but then they ended up, like, in the hospital or with a broken arm or something, and the doctor wanted to put them on painkillers, and they, like, didn't want to go on painkillers because they knew they'd have a problem with it. So when you had, like, your heart surgery, did the doctor know that you had been addicted, and was it an issue yet? Were medical people thinking that way yet? Like, maybe you shouldn't be on a painkiller, but after heart surgery, you probably kind of have to be. Like, how was that handled?
Yeah, you know, interesting subjects. You know, my heart, that was from endocarditis, which is sort of a junkie staph infection. And, you know, at the time they said, you know, you're going to have to deal with this kind of in the next 10 years. Like, essentially your valve is now sort of flipped and not operating properly, which can lead to terrible things, namely sudden death. It's not something you want to have happen. Luckily, the heart seems to be the thing they've really cracked as far as mechanics go. So when I eventually went in to deal with this, kind of, you know, I'd already been off of drugs and kind of living a very, you know, clean life for probably a decade. And that was part of what made it so additionally absurd and complex, you know, having to, in many ways, I think it would have been easier to kind of get open heart surgery, you know, while OD'd or something, against sort of against my will, just like waking up and having, you know, some sort of zigzag staples down my sternum. instead, as it was, I had to sort of like walk in stone cold sober. And I remember holding my best friend Chloe 70's hand. You know, I'm not a big family person. I just kept being like, so I don't understand. You know, you don't get, is there like a Valium involved here? Or how does this work? And they'd made me quit smoking. So I think they were highly alarmed when I pulled out my vape cigarette as I laid down on the table. and I was like, but this is terrifying. They were like, what are you doing? And I was like, I'm sorry. I'm nervous, you know. And yeah, I made it through somehow. And then on the other side of it, yes, you know, I was heavily monitored, as you can tell by today. It doesn't seem like it's a big mystery or secret to anyone, my drug history. So it's not something I really have the option of lack of transparency around in this life. And that's A-OK, because hopefully it's of use to someone somewhere. And it helps me to not have to, you know, lead a double life. It can be very forthcoming and honest and whatever. So certainly all these top surgeons and everybody knew about my opiate history, and it was heavily monitored. But no, you can't really get through the recovery process of you know, having your rib cage chainsawed open and stapled back together without the use of some pain medication. It's not something I would recommend recreationally to do. The opioids or the open heart surgery, both are bad ideas as far as if you have an option to not do those things. Don't do them.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Natasha Lyonne, and she co-created, co-writes, she's directed episodes of, and stars in the Netflix series Russian Doll. She also is one of the stars of Orange is the New Black. We're going to take a short break, then we'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Natasha Lyonne, and she co-created and stars in the Netflix series Russian Doll, and she's one of the stars of Orange is the New Black. You've mentioned that you lived with your parents in Israel a couple of years. You went to yeshiva, which is a Hebrew school, and you studied Talmud there. So were your parents Orthodox?
Well, they were both really the black sheep of these highly Orthodox families. But even still, you know, they were pretty religious. And I would say that later in life, you know, it became a real source of questioning. You know, I'd effectively felt like I'd been almost, you know, brainwashed or kind of like in a propaganda machine. I remember when my parents left from New York to Israel in the 80s, I went there with this kind of fantasy of becoming, you know, the next Golda Meir. She was my big childhood icon. And you know, the truth was we hadn't gone there for Zionism at all. It was actually tax evasion. And so as I began to sort of understand the world I was really in versus the one I was sort of being led to believe I was in, and, you know, I would see like the, you know, alcoholism and ego and self sort of run roughshod over my family life.
When you were a child, your parents got you a deal with the Eileen Ford Modeling Agency. How old were you?
I'm trying to remember. I mean, I was probably six, seven, eight, whatever, six. By eight, I think I was on, no, by six maybe I was on Pee Wee's Playhouse. So maybe I was younger. Maybe I was four.
So it was before Pee Wee's Playhouse.
I think so. I think I was, you know how it works, Terry. I was a model first and I segued into acting. So... And now, you know, I'm segueing, directing, writing, producing, what have you. That's the life of a child model, baby.
So what did you do when you were four and you were signed to, did you get commercials?
Yeah, I did so many commercials. I remember I did like 60 commercials, all of which I had a fantasy would go into my Lamborghini that I wanted to buy, my Lambo. But nope, they just went into the family money supply. So I did these commercials. One of them was Minute Maid. Mamma mia, the amount of concentrated cans of Minute Maid I drank would make you sick. I can still taste it. You know, being a child actor is altogether, it makes no sense. You know, it really, like, I remember Pee Wee's Playhouse as a very positive experience because it was sort of closer to Imagination Land. You know, just the idea of Cherry and Jambi and that there was like a dinosaur hole. The whole thing was sort of such a happy place to work. But by and large, kind of, you know, cattle calls and weird auditions and having, you know, a strange parent kind of bringing you around Manhattan and then getting lost by yourself in Times Square trying to find your parents and not mess up the shot even when you're exhausted. It's a very weird gig, and one I was definitely sort of exhausted with by the time I was 16, I would say.
So were you doing this because your parents saw it as a payday?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think they had their own sort of grandiose fantasies, which is, I think, something that I really rebelled against, you know, as I became a teenager with kind of self-will. I sort of saw acting as my parents' dream, which is how I ended up going to Tisch to study film and not to study drama. You know, I think I thought of that as something that was their fantasy, not my own. I think I always... you know, and again, at this point in my life, I'm so grateful for the experience because, you know, I love having a life in the arts and it's my whole trip. So how lucky is that?
I want to talk a little bit about Orange is the New Black because we talked before about, you know, having an addiction problem earlier in your life. And in Orange is the New Black, which for anyone who isn't aware is set in a women's prison, and the main character in it is in the prison for having been involved with selling heroin. And your character in it is someone who's been addicted. And even in prison, she's involved in a scheme to sell heroin. But I'm wondering what it was like for you to get the part in this series and play somebody who'd been an addict and who was now in prison. So how did you get the part? Did they know your past? And did that contribute at all to them thinking of you?
Definitely spent a few nights in holding cells. I got a call out of the blue to an offer to be in the finale of Weeds, this two-part finale of Jenji Kohan's show Weeds, and I was so excited. In it, I was going to play Kevin Nealon's piece of the week or something, and had a big orange spray tan, a little leopard dress, big frosted lips, teetering in heels. And while I was in that trailer, I got the script for Orange is the New Black, and it said Genji's name one more time. So it felt like a bizarre coincidence that I can now see was no coincidence at all. I think that she already had a Nikki Nichols and Orange is the New Black in mind. So it was sort of came that way. You know, I auditioned for it and all those things. I was so eager to be in it. And in my 7 years at Orange is the New Black, you know, it was a huge gift and kind of healing and way back to life for me, that show.
In what way was it a way back to life?
You know, it was just really a safe place. It was not shame-based. You know, when you talk about the sort of stereotype of femininity, it wasn't something that I felt like I had to, you know, hide a pockmark or something. You know, you get those from picking at your skin under certain conditions. They make you look like Ray Liotta. Love Ray Liotta. Anyway, you know, this was not a show where that was going to be a problem. A cast of women that were just all so exceptional in their own ways that it was sort of realizing that, you know, we'd been sold a false bill of goods through advertising and certainly a life in showbiz where there was only space for a certain number of women and those are your enemies. Here was the opposite. You know, it was the idea that these are your allies. This is your community.
I want to get back to Russian Doll, your new series on Netflix. So your character in Russian Doll says the line, I have the internal organs of a man twice my age.
Yes, like that, for example, is a very me line.
You wrote that? I was wondering if you wrote that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's so interesting that you said of a man twice my age as opposed to the internal organs of a woman twice my age. So tell us about saying of a man.
Yeah. I mean, like those speeches, those are the ones where really, all that about the one in practical application or this, I have the internal organs of a man twice my age. And let's smoke, an Israeli joint laced with cocaine, just like the Israelis do it. These are all sort of my mini zingers, that I bring along for the ride. You've spent much time listing all the things my organs have been through. and so I think we know where that line comes from. I think I often say it because, I'm so cherubic in the face. And so it's funny that people tend to forget that there's a... nothing but blacked out organs in here.
Sorry and, for laughing.
I associate that with enough with all the he, she, what have you. Come on, it's 2019, I think. And yeah, I like the idea of a character that kind of refers to themselves as a man. Why not? I mean, when I say that line, that's how I say it. So it was a kind of discussion of like, shouldn't it be a woman twice my age? And I was like, I've never said it that way, and I wrote the thing. So these are the things you fight for.
Well, Natasha Lyonne, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
My interview with Natasha Lyonne was recorded in May. She's nominated for Emmys in two categories for her work on Russian Doll, Outstanding Lead Actress and Outstanding Writing for a Comedy Series. After we take a short break, we'll hear from Christina Applegate, who's also nominated in the category Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series, for her performance in Dead to Me. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, offering a variety of credit card options with features for a range of customers, from foodies to travelers. Capital One. What's in your wallet? Credit approval required. Capital One Bank, USA, N.A. And from the Maine Office of Tourism, with wild landscapes and rugged coasts to inspire original lifestyles and authentic adventures, Maine offers travelers an opportunity to discover their very own Maine thing at visitmaine.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Emmy Week on Fresh Air, featuring interviews with some of this year's Emmy nominees. Christina Applegate is nominated as Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for her performance in the Netflix series Dead to Me. She was 16 when she became famous for her role as Kelly Bundy, the daughter in the hit sitcom Married with Children. She went on to star in other TV shows and to star with Will Ferrell in the movie comedy Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy. The people behind her current series, Dead to Me, describe it as a traumedy, a comedy drama that deals with trauma and with guilt. Applegate plays Jen, a grieving widow raising two children. Her husband was recently killed in a car accident. She's expressing her grief through anger, like in the opening scene when a well-intentioned neighbor knocks on Jen's door, offering a dish she's prepared for Jen and her children.
So you just heat it up at 300 and leave it in for 35 minutes. Thanks, Karen. But you really don't have to.
It's my take on Mexican lasagna.
Great.
It's nothing. We just don't want you to think you're alone. Mm. Jeff and I are here for you if you ever want to talk.
Thanks.
Just can't imagine what you're going through.
Well, it's like if Jeff got hit by a car and died suddenly and violently. Like that.
Jen starts going to a grief support group where she's befriended by Judy, played by Linda Cardellini, who explains she's there because her fiancé died of a heart attack. But nothing is as it seems in this series, which is filled with surprising plot twists and character revelations. All of season one is streaming on Netflix. Christina Applegate, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
It's really hard to talk about the storyline of this series because there are so many reveals, so many kind of surprising twists and turns that I feel like almost anything I can say is a spoiler.
Yeah.
What we can say for sure is that the two main characters, yours and Linda Cardellini's characters, are both dealing with grief. And what did you think of the idea of dealing with grief comedically?
Well, as Liz always says,
she's the creator of the series.
Yes, she's the creator of Dead to Me. There is always, in that darkest parts of your life, you're trying to find the humor in life because you need some repose. And I think that the way it's written is not jokes. It's people just trying to like have a minute away from all the pain that they're feeling. And I love the idea of this grief being so completely messy and unexpected and unapologetic, especially for my character, Jen, who's operating in the world not from any kind of like thought. She's really just trying to survive. She's trying to keep her head above water. And there's a lot of shame in that. There's shame in like not stopping your grief when everyone wants you to stop your grief. I mean, I've been there. I've had times in my life that were so incredibly painful. And I, in other people's eyes, wasn't dealing with it the way I should have dealt with it. And that's really hard because you don't know how how else to deal with it but the way that you are feeling.
Were you grieving for a person when you went through that or the loss of something else?
I've lost people and, you know, health issues and things like that all kind of around the same time a few years ago. So that was a really dark time. So I really related to that when I got the script, and it's not something I had to really pull from. It just lives there. It lives in the fibers of your being and in your spirit and in your soul. It stays there.
You mentioned grieving for health reasons, for body reasons. I'm thinking you're probably referring at least in part to your double mastectomy.
Well, yes. That was a really tricky time.
Yeah, this was in 2008?
Yes.
So can I ask you a few questions about that? Is that all right? You've been public
Sure.
about it. A lot of women go through this, and I think it's helpful to hear people talk about it. There's nothing shameful about it.
There's nothing shameful about it, but there is that feeling that's there. And I think that's one of the reasons I wanted it to be in the show.
We haven't mentioned that yet. It's in the show.
Yeah, well, it's in the show.
And we find out about it a little deeper in. But it's one of the things that has kind of interfered with intimate relations between your character and her now late husband. So was it your idea to put that in the show?
Yeah, and I think they beautifully put it in there, that it wasn't something that we harped on. It was something that Jen like very flippantly kind of mentions that, you know, like wants to just sort of dismiss it at first. But then come episode 9, when she talks about the pain of it, I think it was important for women who have gone through this to be heard, because so often we're told, like, you know, people would constantly say to me, well, you know what, the good point is that you saved your life and this, but, and God, man, when you're going through it, those kinds of reactions are really disturbing because no one really understands how you actually feel. And I think I did a disservice to myself at the time in a way by kind of being a champion for it and not being really honest with my own self about how I felt. And I think that's why I wanted to sort of live that out and let women who have gone through it know that we all feel, in Jen's words, disgusting sometimes.
Yeah, so what were some of the things you felt you weren't being totally honest about because you were trying to be like a role model?
I was trying to be a role model, but I was also trying to lift myself up, you know, and denying myself sort of those feelings, because those feelings are there. It's been many years for me, so I'm much more used to my life, my body now, you know, but it's an amputation, and you physically and emotionally go through so much when you lose a part of you, especially a part of you that defines you as a female and all of those other things. And it gives, you know, it feeds babies. And there's a lot of reasons that it's a very personal surgery.
Yeah. So you had breast cancer in one breast, but then you got the genetic test. Your mother had breast cancer too. She survived, and you got the genetic test, and found out that you were positive for the BRCA1 gene, which is the gene that is believed to be connected to breast cancer. And that's what made you decide to...
And ovarian.
I didn't know about the ovarian. Really?
Yeah. My mom had both breast cancer and ovarian cancer, and she's BRCA. My cousin passed away right after my surgery from ovarian cancer. She was BRCA. There's definitely, apparently a tie between those two things. Your chances of getting ovarian cancer when you're BRCA are 50%, and your chances of recurrence of breast cancer is somewhere between 75 and 80%.
Was this a hard decision to make, or were you confident that you had to do it?
I was very against the idea of it for a long time. My doctors were trying to convince me, and I was very against the idea. And then it hit me one day, just, do I want to be having this hanging over my head for the rest of my life? And no, I didn't want to be living in that kind of fear forever. I still get checked up. I'm checked up all the time, but it was just, it just was the right thing for me to do.
So just one other thing I want to say about the mastectomy is that you went public with it, but I would suspect in the back of your mind you were wondering not only how it will affect your life and relationships, but will it affect your work? Will it affect your roles? And I love that you kind of...
Well, considering I don't show my boobs anywhere, it wasn't like a concern for me at all. And I didn't want to go public. I had actually kept it a secret for many, 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 many months. And then I had two surgeries before my mastectomy. I had two lumpectomies months before. And it wasn't until I was in the hospital for more than a few days that someone saw me and called the tabloids or whatever. Is that like a thing? Do they still exist? Tabloids?
Yeah, they do.
I have no idea. Yeah. Okay, unfortunately. And had called, so they had outed me basically that I was in the hospital and we had to make a statement. But I wasn't, like, my plan really wasn't to talk about it because it didn't really matter. It was my personal story. But then at the same time, you know, an MRI saved my life. And because of that, I started my foundation, Right Action for Women, which we provide funding for women of high risk for their annual MRIs, and also a website that can educate you to know what it means to be high risk and what kind of steps you can take. So there was a silver lining in there as well.
Well, let me reintroduce you here, and we'll take a short break. If you're just joining us, my guest is Christina Applegate. She stars in the Netflix series Dead to Me. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Westin Hotels and Resorts, offering a range of wellness options for guests, including their Eat Well menu, on-demand fitness gear lending program, and signature heavenly bed. Learn more at westin.com. A member of Marriott Bonvoy. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Christina Applegate. She stars with Linda Cardellini in the Netflix series Dead to Me, which has been renewed for a second season. All of season one is streaming. So you became famous when you were 16 for your role as Kelly Bundy, the daughter on Married with Children. I'm going to ask you to describe the character.
Oh, Kelly Bundy.
And I'm curious if you can use the word ditzy, because that's the word everybody seems to use.
Ditzy, yeah. Lazy thinker. I guess, you know, I had to play her as a genius. You know, in her own mind, she's a genius and a virgin, actually. Those are my little secrets that I had about her. You know, was really kind of a product of that time. The script had, you know, the show had been written, and they actually had shot the pilot with two other actors playing Kelly and Bud. It just didn't work out, so they came back and had us do it. And originally, Kelly was kind of a tough little rebellious, almost like biker kind of chick. And it just didn't, something wasn't for me fitting. And luckily, at that time, no one saw Fox that first year.
This was like the first sitcom that it had,
right?
It
was the very first show that ever aired on Fox, and it wasn't even really a network. Well, that's what they used to tell us when it would come time for negotiations. Like, but we're not really a network. So no, you don't get that kind of money. Anyway, it kind of evolved or devolved, as if you want to call it that, after I had seen this girl in this documentary, and I went, oh my God, I need to, that's it, that's her. So we kind of changed her up to be sort of the product of the 80s, of this generation of girls that felt they needed to use their bodies to further in the world, and the music was heavy metal, and there was, you know, sorry, pardon me, like rock sluts and videos, and sort of kind of evolved from that idea.
What was the documentary you watched?
It was called Decline of the Western Civilization,
oh,
Part 2,
that.
The Metal Years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
And there was a girl in it who, she had just won Miss Gazaris, and she was sitting there, I believe, in a white mini dress, which I had never really seen anyone wear. They asked her, like, what she wanted to do after winning Miss Gazaris, and she said, I want to continue with my modeling and my actressing. And I went, that's the best thing I've ever seen in my entire life. And literally the next day, I went to the wardrobe people and to everyone, and I said, we're changing this up. I'm going to change it up.
Let's hear a clip from Married with Children. So this was on for 11 seasons from 87 to 97?
I think it was
86 to 97? Okay.
I think so. Something like that.
So, you know, it's
I was 15 when we started, so...
Oh, you were 15? I thought you were 16.
Well, I was 15 when we shot it.
Okay. So, you know, the series is about a suburban family. The father is a shoe salesman, hates his job. He's very condescending to his wife, who he expects to cook and clean, but because she sees herself as a bit of a suburban goddess, she hates to cook and clean, so she just sits around and watches TV all day. And you're the kind of sexualized daughter who you say is actually a virgin. So usually when you entered a scene the first time in each episode, there'd be like these cheers and whistles and everything. So here you are making your entrance in this episode of Married with Children.
Hey, where's Bud? I want to tell him that I've got a big date tonight. I love ruining his Saturday nights. Oh my God, it's Sunday? I gotta be at work. How did I lose a day? I must have magnesia. What did Gilligan do when he had magnesia? Oh, my God, I don't remember. Gadzooks, I'm losing my short-term memories.
I'm sure gadzooks is a word you say a lot.
Gadzooks.
So what was it like to make an entrance with such hollering and hooting? And how much of that was real and how much of that was like a sign flashing to the studio audience?
No. There was no signs. This was all real. In fact, most of the time we had to tell them to stop because it would go on for too long for any of our entrances, for Eddie's, for mine. And it would actually start to kind of like mess up the timing of the scenes. So we would actually have to ask the audiences to like cool it. We didn't have a laugh track, none of that. This was all like those 200 people, like at a sporting event, basically. You know, I tried to tune it out because if I had like played into that, it would be a whole other ball game. But I had to stay in my scene and do my work, do my job. And hopefully they would stop at a certain time so I could say my first line.
So the series was considered very raunchy in its time.
So tame compared to what's
I know. But there was pressure from the right that this was like an anti-family show, that it was too sexualized. There was a letter-writing campaign. Mm-hmm. How much attention did you pay to that?
None. It actually made us more popular.
Made it seem more controversial and more edgy.
Yeah, we actually used to send like a fruit basket to Terry Rakolta every year.
Who started the letter writing campaign.
God bless her, because thank you. We had a great run because of that.
So you were born into show business in a way. Your mother was an actress and singer. She sang backup on Leonard Cohen's first album. I thought that was interesting.
Did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about her career.
Her career started in New York. She was in a group called the Bitter End Singers for many years back in the 60s, early 60s. And then she made this really beautiful album called You've Come This Way Before in the late 60s, which was around the time she met my dad. And then she was in L.A. then at that time and, you know, continued to act here and there. But then she had a baby and she was on her own. That baby was me. There's only me. I mean, I do have a brother and sister through my father and his previous wife. But, you know, she was alone. And so that's kind of how I started doing it, is that she couldn't afford childcare. So I would end up going on auditions with her or going to, she was part of a playwright group. And I would end up, they would put me in the plays because she couldn't find anyone to watch me. And that's kind of where it all sort of happened.
You were on screen when you were 3 months old and 5 months old. What were the roles? And were you playing your mother's
Do they call them roles? Yes, I was playing my mother's child. That's the thing.
Is it an infant walk-on?
Yes. It was with my mom. She was on Days of Our Lives, like one or two episodes or something, and that character had a baby, and luckily she had a baby. And then she did a Playtex nurse commercial, but she had a baby, so it was perfect. And it's really funny. Because she's like, she spits up less and has less gas. And that's what my mom said.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Christina Applegate, who became famous as a teenager for her starring role as the daughter in Married with Children. And many roles later, she is now starring in the Netflix series Dead to Me, which has just been renewed for a second season. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Christina Applegate. She stars with Linda Cardellini in the Netflix series Dead to Me, which has just been renewed for a second season. All of season one is streaming. So in addition to doing movies and TV, you did a Broadway revival of Sweet Charity. The music in that show is so good.
Isn't it the best? Oh, my God.
Yeah. And you had to basically audition for the composer, Cy Coleman. What was that like?
Rest in peace, Cy Coleman, but now I can talk about how it was. it was really difficult. The audition process was really, it was something else. You know, I'm a huge Fosse fanatic. Sweet Charity was one of my favorite movies. All That Jazz is in my top five of all time. I mean, this was like my dream come true. But I went to New York to audition, and I was there for, I mean, it felt like 10 hours, and it probably was 10 hours of singing audition, and then, you know, this, all the scenes I had to do, and then the dancing. And I was there for it, just for hours. But apparently, at the end of the day, after the audition was over, and Barry Weissler came into the dressing room, Barry and Fran came in and said, "Can you give us a year?" And I was sat there and I said, "Can you give me a minute?" I mean, I was like drenched in sweat. And I had kind of wanted to go just to have the experience of having a New York audition. I didn't even know if I had wanted to really make the commitment to do this at that time. I just wanted the experience of that. So I needed a minute. And then I get the call that Cy was not convinced of my singing, which I don't blame him. I mean, it's not my strong suit. And he wanted to have another work session in Los Angeles with me. And it was really, really challenging. The way they operate, in not everyone in New York, but the way they talk to you is not fluffy like they do out in Hollywood. He was tough on me, really tough on me. And I thought I was going to like burst into tears many times during that work session. It was really, really hard. And I got back in the car and I called them and I said, "Look, I don't even want to do it, because if they're going to be like this, like, I, you know." And they said, "Well, Cy Coleman just called and he completely like thinks you're magical and you got the job." And I was like, "Say what?" How did that happen? I thought he hated me. It was so scary. But it was amazing to be around him, this man who's, you know, written all this incredible music.
So you said he was tough on you. What did he do that seemed so tough?
"Stop moving your arm. Stop doing it that way. Why are you singing it like that? Start again. Start like really what you think would happen in those in a work session." Like literally like the ingenue getting completely like verbally abused. But I think that's just who he was. You know, he was just a very strong man with he knew what he wanted. No one's like fuzzy in the Broadway world, you know. It's a tough job and they got to make sure you're doing it right. So, you know, when we got there, it was wonderful. I mean, incredible. The rehearsal process was just so much fun and so filled with so much joy for me. But they're, you know, they can be tough on you.
Well, let's hear you sing from the cast recording. And
oh boy.
This is "If My Friends Could See Me Now," which has such a great lyric by Dorothy Fields. So here's my guest, Christina Applegate.
"If they could see me now, that little gang of mine, I'm eating fancy chow and drinking fancy wine. I'd like those stumble bums to see for a fact the kind of top drawer first rate chums I attract. All I can say is wow, we look at where I am tonight. I landed pow right in a pot of jam. What a setup, holy cow, they'd never believe it if my friends could see me.
That's Christina Applegate from the revival of Sweet Charity, recorded in 2005. Do you just love Dorothy Fields' lyrics?
Oh my God, the whole score is just so, it's so amazing. I mean, and with Cy's music, I mean, you can't go wrong when you hear like do 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 boo do. I mean, come on, it's like I get chills when I hear that. It's just perfect.
So you've been critical in tweets about President Trump, and you've gotten a lot of hate tweets as a result. And some people say, like, why do celebrities like weigh in with political opinions like this? Like, you know, what do you know, and what gives you the right? And you've had some.
And yet you look on their Twitter, and they're doing the same thing. What gives you the right?
Yes, exactly. Which was
you
one,
work in a bank.
That was
what are you talking about, man?
So one of the things you were criticized for is like you don't get it. And I think what you didn't get is like, well, what is it really like to be like a working American? And you tweeted back, "I grew up in an abusive home. Now I make it public. Don't you dare say I don't understand. Don't you dare say I don't understand the struggles. We lived on food stamps. Don't you dare say I don't know."
God, I was so mad that day.
Yeah. It's like your character.
I was in a pissy mood.
But what's this about an abusive home?
I don't want to get into that, but I will say that I come from my past is no different, and also probably a lot darker than a lot of people's. And I'm not going to say a lot darker than most people's. I'm saying that I have lived along the same lines as some of the horror stories that you hear out there. And I've lived it. I've seen it. I've lived through it. So I really do take offense when people think that I've had a silver spoon in my mouth and right. that I haven't seen the dark side of life.
Yeah.
And you know what? And if I hadn't, then I don't know if I could have played Jen the way that I did. So, like, that's how I kind of feel about that.
All right. Well, Christina Applegate, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My interview with Christina Applegate was recorded in June. She's nominated for an Emmy in the category Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for her performance in the Netflix series Dead to Me. Our series of interviews with Emmy nominees continues through Labor Day. If you'd like to catch up on Fresh Air interviews you missed in the series with Bill Hader, John Mulaney, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Ben Stiller, Patricia Arquette, Ava DuVernay, and Michael K. Williams, check out our podcast. You'll find lots of Fresh Air interviews. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zadie, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed. With its skills tests built for employers who want to see a deeper sense of the person behind the resume. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where research findings on how the immune system could attack cancer were shared worldwide to help change the course of cancer care. More at DanaFarber.org/beatcancer.